In recent years, the U.S. Supreme Court has handed gun rights advocates a string of stunning victories, ruling for the first time in American history that the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees an individual's right to own a gun. Yet the Second Amendment remains the most misunderstood and explosive part of the Bill of Rights, which has grown only more contentious after a series of horrific mass shootings. Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, a nonpartisan law and policy institute that focuses on improving the systems of democracy and justice. He was director of speechwriting for President Bill Clinton from 1995 to 1999 and is author of My Fellow Americans, POTUS Speaks. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Waldman to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Looking at where we are in regards to the Second Amendment and wanting to write a biography, what do you think ultimately it is important for us to know about the amendment?
I think what was most striking to me as I looked at the history, as you said, going back from colonial times till today, is that the way we see the Second Amendment is really a window on how we see the Constitution, how we see the role of government, how we see individual rights at any moment in American history. It's always been the subject of controversy, of contention, and political organizing, just like we see today, and that's not really a surprise.
Nor should, I guess, we be surprised by the fact that it probably always will be, right?
I think you can't bet with too much certainty on anything, but you probably could take a bet on that. It's really an interesting thing. I mean, I started working on this after Newtown, when once again we were debating gun laws for the first time in several years. And this time, the Second Amendment was articulated by so many at the front of their concerns, and it was the first time that we were debating gun laws as a country after the Supreme Court ruled in 2008 that it actually gives an individual right to a gun and to own a gun, and so many people are surprised to learn that that did not happen until 2008. So I wanted to know, well, what really does this amendment mean? It's short, it's sort of fractured, there's a lot of commas in funny places, and people aren't quite clear about what it all means. And when you go back to look at it from its beginning, it really meant something very different in the colonial period, in the period of the American Revolution and Constitution, than it means today. We've sort of reinterpreted it as we've gone along.
You make the point that for 218 years, judges overwhelmingly concluded that the amendment simply authorized states to form militias, which we now call the National Guard. And for our first two centuries of American history, that's pretty much how it was received.
That's right. And it wasn't several times the Supreme Court ruled that way. And in fact, the former Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger, who was a strong conservative appointed by Richard Nixon, he said the idea that it did anything else was a, quote, fraud on the American people. But it's interesting. The militias, so the amendment, as probably people know by heart, or some of us know by heart, the amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. These days, the militias are what we call the National Guard. They were something different back then. The militia was the military forces of the 13 states, and it was a form of almost a universal draft. Every single man, every white man eventually, every white man was required to be in the militia from age 16 to 60, and they were required by law to own a gun, to own a military weapon, and to keep it at home and bring it in for their militia service. So these days people say, well, what did the amendment protect? Did it protect the militias or to protect individual rights? The answer is both and neither. It protected the right to own a gun, to perform the duty serving in the militia. And people back then were very fond of the militias. They believed they were the way to fight tyranny, to make sure that there wouldn't be what they were really worried about, some people who opposed the Constitution of the United States. They were worried that there would be a standing army, an army controlled by the President of the United States and Congress that would somehow be like King George. And they thought those militias were going to be the way to stand up to it. And that fight over the Constitution and over armies and over military force, that was what led to the Second Amendment in this great debate over the Constitution.
And you make the point that that question of did the Second Amendment protect militias or an individual right to a gun, that even that question would make little sense to the framers.
The question would make little sense to the framers, just like their answer makes little sense to us today. It, as far as they were concerned, if you were a man, you were in the militia, and you had to own a gun. And they passed a law right after they passed the Second Amendment, right after it was ratified. 2 months later, the U.S. Congress passed a law confirming and requiring everybody to buy a gun. And the funny thing that happened after the Second Amendment was ratified, after this huge fight over the Constitution, very quickly after that, the militia system crumbled. People just stopped showing up. You know, the country changed. We became more individualistic, moved out west. People were more interested in making money. And you no longer had this sense of civic duty that you had to be a patriot and participate in the militia. But our understanding of what gun rights meant and what the appropriate way to deal with that issue was changed over time, too. I mean, basically, over time, the country grew where there were plenty of guns. Just ask Alexander Hamilton, right? There were guns from the very beginning. There were plenty of guns, but there were also plenty of gun laws, what we would now call gun control laws. And gun rights and gun laws were seen as going hand in hand. There was not this view that there's a kind of a pure right that where the Constitution prevents you from having gun safety laws or anything like that.
You make the point in the book of just looking at how the interpretation of the amendment has changed over time, that Warren Burger, a conservative chief justice named by Richard Nixon, said that the idea that the Second Amendment gave you an individual right to own a gun was a fraud.
And there was he was not alone in that view. I mean, you had even the National Rifle Association in an earlier incarnation, when it was principally focused on marksmanship training and hunt and protecting the rights of hunters, it testified in support of the first federal gun law in the 1930s. And a member of Congress said, well, what about the Constitution? What about the Second Amendment? And the official of the NRA said, oh, we haven't given it any thought from that perspective. The idea that this provision, which was little cited by judges, by lawyers, which was not taken terribly seriously, that somehow would strike down laws and govern how we deal with this issue was going to be a surprise to a lot of people over a long time. Now, you know, we've had differing and shifting attitudes toward guns in the country. After the Civil War, there was effectively a kind of guerrilla warfare in the South, where the newly freed slaves, many of whom had served in the Army, the Union Army, were terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan and white vigilantes. And one of the purposes of the 14th Amendment, pushed through by the lawmakers known then as the Radical Republicans, one of the purposes of the 14th Amendment was to make sure that those freed slaves could get guns, that there couldn't be laws to take away their guns. So, you know, these issues have risen and recurred throughout history. Only lately, though, only since the 1970s, has it taken on this kind of libertarian idea that it's an individual right to be protected by the courts, and that you really can't touch my freedom by regulating or limiting that right.
Michael Waldman is our guest. The name of the book is The Second Amendment Biography. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Talk a little bit more about the National Rifle Association and ultimately the role that the NRA has played in the debate.
Well, as you can guess, and as we all know, because we all live in, it's a country we live in, it's a significant role indeed. The NRA was started after the Civil War by former Union officers who were worried about the poor marksmanship of the troops. And it trained people how to shoot. It made sure people were ready for military service. And eventually it certainly focused on the interests of sportsmen, of hunters. It was not a fierce lobbying force against all gun laws. Cut to 1977. And you had this period of backlash against the liberalism of the 1960s. One of the places it played out was in the NRA. The organization indicated it was actually going to move its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado. And they had their annual meeting, and it's called even now the Revolt at Cincinnati, because thousands of angry dissidents showed up and took control of the organization, pushed out its leadership, and put in place a much more dogmatic, more conservative leadership, which was focused now on the idea that the mission of the NRA was to protect the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. And in fact, if you go to the headquarters of the NRA in Virginia these days, you go into the lobby, there on the wall is the text of the Second Amendment in big letters. But it's not the whole Second Amendment. They just cut out the part about the well-regulated militia. They have a couple of dots. And you have to look carefully to realize you're not seeing the whole thing. It became a constitutional crusade. And this really was not the view of the courts, not the view of scholars about what the Second Amendment meant. So the NRA worked really hard and very effectively. It supported, put a lot of resources into scholarship, to people going and writing law review articles to show that, in fact, the founding fathers meant that it should be an individual right. Then public opinion shifted. The political branches shifted. You had, politicians now saying that they believed it should be an individual right. So that by the time the case went to the Supreme Court in 2008, it sort of fell like a ripe apple from the tree. It wasn't ultimately that controversial that it ruled in the Heller case that there was an individual right, a limited individual right, but for the first time that there was a right.
Well, let's talk about that case, District of Columbia versus Heller, an opinion written by Justice Antonin Scalia, declared that the Constitution confers a right to own a gun for self-defense in the home. You write in the book that Heller shows, quote, how a generation of conservative judges and scholars transformed the way we interpret the Constitution. How so?
Well, Justice Antonin Scalia, of course, is a very prominent voice for an approach to the Constitution called originalism. And it's the idea that the only legitimate way to look at any provision of the Constitution is to ask what the framers meant in 1791, say. Not looking at that as one of the things, but also asking how has the country evolved and what are the facts of the case, all those kinds of things, the way judges have looked at it most of the country's history. Scalia and other conservative judges have said, no, the only legit way is to ask, what did it mean at the time? Even if it's meant something different in between. And so Justice Scalia said that the Heller case was, as he put it, the vindication of this approach. And it was very historical in the way he wrote about it. But he sort of skipped over the part about the militias, too, just like that sign in the lobby of the NRA headquarters. He really focused on things like dictionaries, looking at what the word keep or bear or arms meant in different dictionaries in the 1700s. But what's interesting is this. He also says that while it's an individual right, that there are limits to it. He actually mentions a variety of limits, felons being able to be prohibited from having guns and other things like that. And so that the right as proclaimed was not nearly as sweeping as the claims he made for it. My concern with the opinion is especially not so much the outcome, but the idea that the court could pretend that it was just relying on the original intent, when in fact it was relying on this very long-term advocacy and lobbying campaign right now. You know, there's a broad public consensus over many years that, you know, there's some kind of individual gun right, and that's what the court was reflecting. It's a quite controversial decision. Liberals kind of shrugged about it, said, well, what do you expect? A lot of conservative judges and scholars denounced it strongly, saying that it was just the kind of loosey-goosey constitutionalism that conservatives had been attacking in their response to cases like Roe versus Wade or other cases that were finding new or articulating new rights in the Constitution.
You ultimately, in the book, call for judicial restraint, that you would rather see future gun laws written in a more grassroots level than decided ultimately by the courts.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, that is the way it's been throughout the country's history. There's been the push and pull of political advocacy and debate. We've found ways to balance personal freedom and public safety. And we've relied on the democratically accountable elected branches of government to do this. A place I should note where I don't notice that the NRA is doing too badly. It doesn't seem like it ought to be necessary for the NRA to run to court. That democratically accountable branch of government is, when possible, the best way to make public policy and social policy. So I do think this is a place where the courts have stayed out of it before, and we'd be better if the courts stayed out of it since. Interestingly, since the Heller case, the overwhelming number of courts, federal and other appeals courts, looking at individual gun laws, trying to figure out how to apply the Supreme Court's ruling to these laws, that's exactly what these judges have done. They've said, you know what, this law, the legislature had a good reason to pass it. So even though there's an individual right, we know there can be limitations on that right. And these current gun safety laws or criminal laws, they still stand. And, you know, I think for a long time it was liberals who wanted judicial restraint, and then for a long time it was conservatives who wanted judicial restraint. And I think probably both sides should recognize that these decisions, when possible, it's better to not have to go to the courts to defend individual rights. It's better if we can find our way to work through the political system.
And this is coming from a man who runs the Brennan Center, a progressive legal institute.
Well, that's right. And, of course, Justice Brennan, who the Brennan Center was named after, was a great Supreme Court justice in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and probably was not identified with the concept of judicial restraint. it's not the first thing that comes to mind. But when, interestingly, when the people who founded the Brennan Center, Justice Brennan was still alive, and they created it as a living memorial to him and his humanist vision of the Constitution, they went to him and said, we want to start this group in your name. How do you feel about that? And he said to them, well, I think it's lovely, it's wonderful on one condition. You cannot simply apply my views to things, because that would be originalism. And you know how I feel about that.
Hmm.
I think that, you know, in addition to the great debate over the role of guns, the debate over how to read the Constitution is something we've been having over many decades as well. Does it evolve with the country? Or is the only way to do it to go back, as I would say, in a time machine and try to ask the guys in powdered wigs what they're supposed to, what we ought to do today? I don't think that latter approach is a realistic way to run a modern country.
The book is very important and fascinating. It is The Second Amendment, a biography. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Michael Waldman, thank you very much for sharing your knowledge with us this morning. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Second Amendment, a biography. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.